Gilbert Keith Chesterton lived from 1874 to 1936. Variety was the hallmark of his career. He was an illustrator, poet, essayist, literary critic, having written major works on Charles Dickens, George Bernard Shaw, and Robert Browning, among others. Novelist, examples being the classic The Man Who Was Thursday, The Ball and the Cross, and Man Alive. Author of the popular Father Brown detective stories, and Christian apologist, The Everlasting Man, and the book which serves as a source for today's material, Orthodoxy. For many years, he was the editor of GK's Weekly and was a contributing columnist for several of London's newspapers. Chesterton was a close friend to both George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells, though he also served as their major critic. During one of his visits to the United States, he debated against Clarence Darrow over the future of religion in the world and was one of the few individuals to defeat the notorious attorney. Born in the Anglican Church, Chesterton drifted away from Christianity, as he admits this morning, but returned to the faith when he was a young man. In 1922, at the age of 48, he joined the Roman Catholic Church. Please be advised that Chesterton is not visiting the late 1980s. This is not theater of the absurd. Despite any anachronisms, you want to put this in here from last year, such as the beeping of a watch or the roar of a lawnmower, we are soon going to find ourselves in the year 1908. Chesterton is 34 years old. He has just finished publishing Orthodoxy. G.K. Chesterton.
Thank you. I feel as though I am participating in some sort of exchange program. For just as I was leaving London, one of your stars was arriving, Mrs. Kerry Nation. And I, like all of London, was hoping that she would bring her axe. But she didn't. And when the reporters asked her about her axe, she said, "The only axe I use is my Bible. The only axe I use is my Bible." Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that a lot like saying that the only galoshes I wear are the Pirates of Penzance? Or that the only toothpick I use is the Pilgrim's Progress? There's a question that is abroad in London that's being asked of every personality, and it goes like this. If you found yourself on a deserted island and you could only have one book, what book would that be? And I have no doubt that Mrs. Nation would answer her Bible, so she could have a book and an axe at the same time. When the question was posed to me, I answered most honestly, "William's Practical Guide to Shipbuilding." I've often had a fancy for writing a romance about an English yachtsman who slightly miscalculated his course and discovered England under the impression that it was a new island in the South Seas. I always find, however, that I'm either too busy or too lazy to write this fine work, so I may as well give it away for purposes of philosophical illustration. They would probably be the general impression that this man who landed on British soil to plant the British flag felt rather like a fool. But I'm not here concerned with whether or not he felt like or even looked like a fool. His mistake, after all, was an enviable mistake. What could be more delightful than to have in the same few moments all the fascinating terrors of going abroad combined with the humane security of coming home again? What could be better than to have all the fun of discovering a new island in the South Seas without the disgusting necessity of landing there? And what could be more glorious than to discover New South Wales and then realize with a gush of happy cheers that it was actually Old South Wales? This seems to me, at least, to be the main problem for the philosopher. How can we contrive to be at once astonished at the world and yet at home in it? But I have another reason for mentioning the man in the yacht who discovered England. I am the man in the yacht. I discovered England under the impression that it was a new island in the South Seas. I do not see how this speech can avoid being egotistical. Nor do I quite see, to be honest, how it can avoid being dull. Dullness, however, will free me from the charge which I most lament, the charge of being flippant. Mere light sophistry happens to be the thing that I despise most of all things in this world, and it is perhaps a wholesome fact that it is the thing of which I am generally accused. But I can think of nothing so contemptible as a mere paradox, an ingenious defense of the indefensible. If it were true, as it has been said, that Mr. George Bernard Shaw lives on paradox, then he ought to be a millionaire. I say, you know, you remind me of Shaw. So painfully thin. All that hair on your face. I ran into Shaw the other day at one of our haunts in London, and when I saw him, I said, Bernard Shaw, to look at you, anyone would think there was a famine in England. And he said, Gilbert, to look at you, anyone would think you were the cause of it. It wasn't that funny, was it? I will tell you that my tendencies to corpulence has its advantages, especially when I'm trying to be gallant. The other day on the bus, I was able to offer my seat to three women. Now, where was I? Oh, yes, Shaw. If it's true that Shaw does live on paradox, then he ought to be a millionaire, because a man of his mental activity could invent a new paradox every 6 minutes. It's as easy as lying. Why? Because it is lying. And the truth is, of course, that Mr. Shaw cannot tell a lie unless he happens to think that it is the truth. And I find myself under the same intolerable bondage. I have never in my life said anything merely because I thought it was funny. Though I must admit that many times I thought something was funny merely because I said it. And so you see, I thought that I was the first one to set foot on English soil, and I discovered that I was the last. Here are my elephantine adventures in the pursuit of the obvious. I freely confess all the idiotic ambitions of the end of the 19th century. I did, like all other solemn little boys, try to be in advance of the age. I tried, like all of them, to be some 10 minutes ahead of the truth, and I found out that I was some 1,800 years behind it. Oh, I did utter my truths with that painfully exaggerated boyish voice. And I was fitfully punished, for I have kept my truths. And I discovered not that they weren't truths, for they were and they are. I've only discovered that they weren't mine. when I fancied that I stood alone, I was actually in the ridiculous position of being backed up by all of Christendom. It may be, heaven forgive me, that I tried to be original, but I only succeeded in inventing all by myself an inferior copy of the existing traditions. The man in the yacht thought that he was the first one to set foot on English soil. I did try to found a heresy. And when I had put the last touches on it, I discovered that it was orthodoxy. And what do I mean by orthodoxy? Those common facts of Christian theology, as they have been sufficiently summarized in the Apostles' Creed. That is orthodoxy. Not too long ago, I was walking down the street with a prosperous publisher, and he made a remark which I've often heard before. It is indeed almost a motto of the modern world. But I'd heard it once too often, and I suddenly realized that there was nothing in it. He remarked of someone, "That man will go on. He believes in himself." There it is. He believes in himself. And I remember that as I lifted my head to listen, my eye caught sight of an omnibus on which was written the word Hanwell. Do you know what Hanwell is? It is a lunatic asylum, notorious in London. And I said to my publishing friend, "Shall I tell you where all the men are who really believe in themselves? I can guide you to the thrones of these supermen, for all men who really believe in themselves are in a lunatic asylum." But my friend answered mildly that there were, after all, a good many men who did believe in themselves who were not in lunatic asylums. I said, "You know, you're right, and you of all people should know who they are. That drunken dramatist from whom you would not accept a dreary tragedy, he believed in himself. That elderly clergyman with his epic from whom you were hiding in the back room, he believed in himself." In fact, if my friend had consulted his business experience instead of his ugly individualistic philosophy, he would have discovered that believing in himself is one of the commonest forms of errata. Actors who can't act believe in themselves, as do debtors who won't pay. And it is better to say that a man who really believes in himself will most certainly fail. Complete self-confidence is not only a sin. Complete self-confidence is a weakness. And the man who really believes in himself has Hanwell written all over his face, as clearly as it was written on that omnibus. Well, my publishing friend asked me, "If a man is not to believe in himself, then what then is he to believe?" And I said, "I'll go home and write a book about that." And I did. Orthodoxy. And I didn't know where to begin. The ancient masters of religion began with the fact of sin, a fact that is as practical as potatoes. Whether or no man could be washed in the miraculous waters of baptism, there was no doubt at any rate that he needed washing. Certain religious leaders in London, however, in our day, have begun not to dispute the highly disputable waters, but they have begun to deny the indisputable debt. Certain new theologians dispute original sin, which is the only fact in all of Christian theology that can really be proved. Now, if it is true, as it most certainly is, that a man can feel exquisite happiness in the evil practice of skinning a cat, then the religious philosopher can draw only one of two conclusions. He must either deny the existence of God, as all atheists do, or he must deny the present union between God and man, as all Christians do. The new theologians seem to think it's a highly rationalistic solution to deny the cat. Well, in this remarkable situation, it is plainly not now possible, with any hope of universal appeal, to begin as our fathers did with the fact of sin. But though the modernists have denied the existence of sin, they have not, I do not believe, denied the existence of a lunatic asylum. Men deny hell, but not as yet Hanwell. So let us begin our journey from the madhouse. And let us from that evil and fantastic inn go on our intellectual way. Now, if we are to glance at the philosophy of sanity, the first thing that we must do in this matter is to blot out one big and common mistake. There is a notion adrift everywhere that imagination, especially mystical imagination, is dangerous to a man's mental balance. Poets are commonly referred to as psychologically unreliable. But facts and history utterly contradict this view. And if ever you have to debate with a psychologist, or a philosopher, or even some of our theologians, let me tell you a trick. For once I debated with a psychologist, an outstanding man in his field, and as we were debating, he said something that only he himself could understand. And everyone applauded. They thought it was wonderful. And I thought, how am I to defeat this man? So I said something that even I didn't understand. And I won. Where was I? Oh, yes, imagination. Imagination does not breed insanity. Exactly what does breed insanity is reason. Now, I'm not in any way attacking logic. No, I only say that the danger of insanity lies in logic and not in imagination. Poets do not go mad. Chess players do. And critics are much madder than poets. Homer was complete and calm enough. It's only his critics who tear him into extravagant tatters. Shakespeare is quite himself, thank you. No, it's only some of his critics who have discovered that he was somebody else. And though St. John the Evangelist saw many strange monsters in his apocalypse, he saw no creature so wild as one of his own commentators. General fact is simple. Poetry is sane because it floats easily on an infinite sea. Reason attempts to cross the infinite sea and so make it finite. To accept everything is an exercise. To understand everything is a strain. The poet only wants to get his head into the heavens. The logician wants to get the heavens into his head. And it is his head that splits. The madman is not the man who has lost his reason. The madman is the man who has lost everything except his reason. And perhaps the nearest I can come to describing it is to say this, that his mind works and moves in a perfect but narrow circle. Now, reason, too, works in a circle, but a much larger circle, to be sure. And while it must be admitted that a small circle is as infinite as a large circle, though it be quite as infinite, it will never be quite as large. And once a man merely moves by reason, he finds himself in that circular rut, and he will go round and round in his logical circle, and he will find himself in the neat and well-lit prison of one idea. And that publishing friend of mine, who thought that men could get on because they believe in themselves, those seekers after the Superman who always seem to be looking for him in their mirrors, they are 1 inch away from this awful emptiness. And when this man who believes in himself finds that the kindly world around him has been blackened, that his friends fade into ghosts, and that the foundations of the world fail, then he will find himself alone in his own nightmare. He will be in that prison, and over his cell will be written with dreadful truth, he believes in himself. They've begun at the wrong end. They're standing on their heads. They don't have their first principles correct, these people who believe in nothing and in no one but themselves. Now, mysticism keeps the man sane. The ordinary man has always been sane because the ordinary man has always been a mystic. For example, if he sees two truths that seemingly contradict each other, he will take the two truths and the contradiction along with it. Thus, he has always believed that there is such a thing as fate, and at the same time, believed that there was such a thing as free will. Thus, he has always believed that children are indeed the kingdom of heaven. Nevertheless, he believes that they ought to be obedient to the kingdom of the earth. He has admired youth because it was young, and old age because it was not. This is exactly this balance of apparent contradictions is what gives him his buoyancy and his sanity. And mind you, we are not yet at this point talking about orthodoxy as it is related to a man's soul. No, the new theologians won't let us do that. We're beginning by discussing orthodoxy in relation to a man's health, a man's sanity. Now, the secret of mysticism is this, that a man can understand everything by the help of what he cannot understand. And just as we took the circle as the symbol of reason and madness, so we may also take the cross as a symbol of mystery and sanity. Christianity is centrifugal. It breaks out. The circle is perfect and infinite in its nature, but it is fixed forever in its size. It can never grow larger or smaller, but the cross, though it has at its heart a conflict and a contradiction, it can extend its forearms forever without altering its shape. Because it has a paradox at its center, it can grow forever. The cross returns upon itself. No, the circle returns upon itself and thus is bound, but the cross opens its arms to the four winds. And there's another symbol that we could take from physical nature. The sun is the one thing, the one created thing which we cannot look at. But it is also the one thing by which we see everything. And remember that the secret of mysticism is that a man can understand everything by the help of what he cannot understand. And so the sun is a symbol of this mysticism, of this orthodoxy. For like the noonday sun, we cannot look into it, but we can see everything by it. And what about this empty intellectualism? Well, it is, as the phrase is now being used, so much moonshine. Because the moon does represent that empty intellectualism. It is light without heat. It is a secondary source. It is reflected from a dead world. And it is entirely appropriate that the moon should stand as the symbol for reason. For she is the mother of lunatics. And she has given them her name. And this is the romance of orthodoxy. Yes, some people speak of orthodoxy as if it was heavy or humdrum or safe. There's never been anything so perilous or exciting as orthodoxy, because orthodoxy is sane. It is poetical. It is mystical. And it is always far more adventurous to be sane than it is to be mad. Now, the church in its early days went wild and fierce. But it is completely unhistoric to say that she went along the pathway of one idea. She swerved from the left to the right, exactly to avoid enormous obstacles. On the one hand, she left that huge bulk of Arianism, buttressed by all the worldly powers which attempted to make the church too worldly. And then in the next instance, she was swerving to miss Orientalism, which attempted to make the church too unworldly. And so she is gone. Because you see, to accept any of these fads would have been tame. But to have missed them all, fashion after fashion and sect after sect that has been thrown in the historic pathway of the church, to have missed them all has been one whirling adventure. To have accepted any of these things would have been easy, because it's easy to be a heretic. It's easy to be a madman. It is easy to be a modernist, just as it is easy to be a snob. But to be orthodox, oh, that's something else. It is a whirling adventure to have missed all of these things, from Gnosticism to Christian Science. And in my vision, I see the heavenly chariot flies through the ages, the dull heresy sprawling and prostrate, the wild truth reeling but erect. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Hannibal. Well done. Well done. He's willing to take some time now. We have about 20 minutes to answer any questions you might have about G.K. Chesterton, about the presentation, and also about himself personally, in terms of how he got started in this sort of thing and how he goes about doing it. It's quite fascinating to realize that he packs all this stuff into his mind and is able to carry with him wherever he goes and do a performance like this, and he does many of them, and sometimes much longer. And So if you have any questions, please feel free. Mr. Robbie.
Did he ever explain why he decided to join the Roman Catholic Church?
Repeat the question.
The question was, did he ever explain why he joined Roman Catholicism? He never explained in a way that I could ever appreciate, though I have many suspicions about it. The first is an evangelical principle. He was dissatisfied with his own church for the reasons that I think he made obvious about the new theology that had entered in, and he happened to have a very good close friend who was a very good staunch Catholic. And so as he was moving away from one direction, this friend Hilaire Belloc was bringing him in to a Roman Catholicism. And he was, I think, an Aristotelian philosopher at heart. And so the Catholic Church opened its arms to him and explained that that didn't bother them at all. So he became, towards the end of his life, he became quite a fan of Aquinas. And I think that these things and many other things added together certainly had a lot to do. But that's one reason why I chose. The Everlasting Man was written 3 years after he converted, though there's nothing in that book that I would deem as essentially Roman Catholic as opposed to being non-Christian, or to being Christian. But I decided to choose Orthodoxy to be safe. We're many years before his conversion. I can finally do someone who is my own weight. Someone who was my own age. And I felt that there wasn't any problems. If we can put Edwards Preuss's Justification of the Sinner in our classical series, I figured I could do Chesterton from this period of 1908.
Anybody else?
Yes, sir. The question was, how did he interact with some of the other great authors of the time? Well, Shaw, I think, was perhaps one of his closest companions in the literary world, and it was funny because they never did agree on anything, nothing. But they enjoyed each other's company. They enjoyed debates, which were always attended to the maximum, and they just had a good time with each other. H.G. Wells was another one that was his friend. Of course, he disagreed with everything that H.G. Wells stood for, but they got along very well. Some of the other writers, most conspicuously, when he began to write the Father Brown stories, which he started in 1910, he became part of the Detection Club, so he rubbed elbows with a lot of the mystery writers, Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and so on and so like that. Beyond that, he just seems to have been immensely popular, not only among the public, but among the literary circles. And to get into a conversation with him just seemed to be what everybody wanted to do. So he was extremely popular. He belonged to all the clubs, all the literary circles, and everybody just loved to debate with him. Mrs. Fremdrich. Classic British education. I don't think he got into college. But he went through the whole. I know he had a very rough education, classical Latin and Greek and so on and so forth, and a lot of philosophy. But he did not go into the graduate level of work. Yes, sir. Many purposes. I enjoy it for one thing. There is some money to be had for another. It is a part-time job for me. Certain characters, St. Paul, Luther, prominent among them, I feel to be an extension of ministry. And others like Mark Twain, just to be able to entertain people is another sort of ministry. I certainly don't equate it to my calling to the parish, but you know, it seems that other people enjoy it. I enjoy it. Yes, sir.
The St. Ignatius Press, the question was that St. Ignatius Press is showing quite an interest in Chesterton. Is there some reason why he stands out? Well, they are publishing all of his works, from all the newspaper columns they can assemble to all the major things, and they're combining. For example, there was a book that preceded Orthodoxy, which was called Heresies, which didn't deal with religion. It dealt with heresies in literary circles. But they published Heresies and this book, Orthodoxy, together in one volume. And to the best of my knowledge, they intend to publish all of his novels and all his other works as well. And I think the reason is Chesterton was sort of a lot like Bach. He was popular when he was alive because of what he did. But I don't think he was ever really appreciated as a giant of the literary field as Shaw and some of his other contemporaries were. But a certain amount of time after his death, this level of appreciation seems to be increasing, so that people are now appreciating Chesterton not just as a figure who was quite entertaining and quite good at it, but also as someone who had some rather important thoughts and so on and so forth. And the fact that he was Catholic, the Catholics are certainly willing to promote anybody that they feel would... he's sort of their ecumenical apostle, because he never writes anything that is fiercely Catholic. I mean, he never writes any staunch defense of the authority of the Pope, or he doesn't go into any elaborate concerns about the cults of saints. The most that he gets into is the entire notion behind penance. And that's about the most Catholic he gets in his writing. So he's not only popular among the Catholics, but he's popular among non-Catholics. And I think they're latching on to that very fact, since there seems to be this general, especially in America, patting on the back between Catholics and Protestants. The question was concerning the debate between Chesterton and Darrow. No, you know, in all the biographies of Darrow, it's not mentioned. It's one encounter that is forgotten. I've only found one single reference to it by one of Chesterton's biographers, that he did indeed debate Darrow in Chicago, and everybody was amazed that he won. So beyond that, I don't know. The substance of the debate has not been published, to the best of my knowledge. But
anybody else?
Yes, sir. Well, it was almost an act of revenge. My sister, when I announced, I remember it was Easter of 1973, that I announced that I was going to enter the ministry. And my sister began to laugh hysterically and say, "You could never speak in public." Well, so the first thing I did when I got to college was I started to assemble some of this Mark Twain material. And so I started, and it was really just to not only show her, but to show myself that I could do it. So this seemed to be the best method for me to get into public speaking, by doing other people. And found out I enjoyed it. But I was invited... if any of you know Paul Hoyer, he's the man to blame for this career, because he invited me to do Mark Twain at the St. Paul's Coffee House in Concordia, Missouri, which was December 1st, 1973, which is how I got started.
How often do you do a presentation like this? Now, do you do them on a regular basis?
The question was, how often do I do them? Luther and Mark Twain, I get more requests than I can handle. Those are the two popular ones, you know, from different churches and organizations, both locally and throughout the country. At the seminary, I've sort of been dedicated to the notion of doing a new character here every April, and been pretty well faithful. Last year I did one of Walther's sermons, and it was 10 years ago that I first did Luther here in Pritzlaff. So, but these are some characters, Chesterton and C.S. Lewis, because of legal issues, are pretty well confined here, but Luther and Mark Twain, I always get more calls, which is a good feeling. I always get more calls than I can answer. Well, it varies. My congregation does give me one Sunday off if I want it, but I don't take advantage of that too often. But usually in the fall, I usually arrange for about 10 Luther engagements in the fall around the period of the Reformation. And usually in the spring, I may have another 10 banquet engagements. And that usually wipes me out. Yes, sir. What steps do I go through in preparing a person? First is, the way I've been doing it lately is to find someone that I'd like to do, of course, first of all. Then it has to be someone that I feel can be translated into verbal presentation without too much difficulty. There has to be enough material that's there to work with. I typically, except in the biblical materials, look for some comic relief that I can latch onto that's legitimate, that actually came from that individual. I look for people who are characters that I feel would be worth presenting and that I would enjoy presenting. Okay, so once I get to that step, and then Chesterton I've been looking at for about 4 years now. Once I get to that point, then comes the hardest part of the whole thing is to select material and make it concise and yet make it flow. So that what we had this morning actually covers about 80, 90 pages of the first part of his book. But I mean, you just have to cut out major portions, but you have to find the other portions that'll make it all seem as if it could be a cohesive presentation. And then comes the part, which I always repent ever having decided to start the person, is that part where you have to memorize what you've edited and assembled. Not that it's so terribly hard for me, but it's the hardest part of the whole process, to commit these things to memory. And I'm always, no matter how well things flow previously, I'm always have doubts that I'm going to be able to do it, that I'm going to forget this word, that I'm going to fall to pieces, that I don't know what I'm going to do, I'm just going to be embarrassed beyond belief. And that's the critical part where I seem to have all my psychological trouble in bringing these people into performance. And then after it's committed to memory, and I do it about 1,000 times to myself while I'm driving, to the children in their car seats, to my wife when she's in bed, after I've done it and I'm quite sure that everything else, then I do it and it stops interrupting my life for a while. Well, sometimes it's quite hard to stifle some of these characters in particular situations. The most dangerous one is that when I was in Fort Wayne, it was an independent study, but I wrote a one-man play based on the life of George Patton and presented it. And there are some circumstances where the tendency to unleash this man is great, but I always have been able to. But normally I keep them in check. Normally.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.